Today in Ideas we examine the concept of resilience. It's a bit like sustainability. We think we understand what it implies, but what does it really mean in practice? It is in effect a strengthening of the capacity of any town, city or country to withstand the knocks imposed either by nature or by man-made mishaps. Developing greater resilience challenges communities to examine the robustness of their infrastructure, both built and natural, in the face of risks imposed by climate change, by economic upheaval, social breakdown, biosecurity or health emergencies and the like. After a series of vicious earthquakes in Christchurch, the concept has become rather more compelling for New Zealanders. And as we come to grips with the long-term impacts of more violent weather events, including drought and the impacts of storm surges around our coasts, we begin to ask, how can we better insulate ourselves and ensure our assets against the risk of disaster? A couple of weeks ago, I hosted a breakfast debate on this issue at Te Papa as part of a Climate Change Research Institute conference on responses to global warming. The panellists were Fred Pearce, a British environmental journalist and author of best-selling books When the Rivers Run Dry and The Climate Files, Professor David Carroll, an Australian climate scientist and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and a well-known science communicator, Martin Kreft, a New Zealand engineer who also plays a leading role in project financing and particularly insurance issues, and Colin James, New Zealand political journalist, author and analyst. I asked each of the panellists for his personal perspective on how important the need is to build greater resilience. I started with Fred Pearce.
Wear is hard, but I think resilience is the key. Looking at things from sort of climate change perspective specifically, we really don't know how in any individual place climate change is going to play out. We know that the world is going to get warmer. We know it's probably going to get more violent in terms of both in terms of our weather, which is, after all, how we experience climate. But we don't know with any... You can plug some numbers into climate models and they will tell you that what the climate might be in Wellington in 2040, but really there's no great confidence around those kind of things. We don't really know what's coming down the track, especially for local places, individual places. So what we need above all is resilience. Resilience to bigger floods, bigger droughts, warmer temperatures, sometimes colder temperatures. Building that in is about perhaps changing from our sort of just-in-time society, that's how we run a lot of our business now, but fine-tuning things to local circumstances in order to cut out any slack in the system seems to be how everybody tries to organise themselves. Everything from making sure that hospital wards are full to ensuring that supermarkets are full, but only on the day that the stuff is needed. And I think that in the wider picture of our society, we can't go on like that. We can't fine-tune things because we don't know. We don't know what a 1-in-100-year flood is anymore if you're an engineer, to take one instance. We have to be more resilient. We have to think more about resilience and building that into absolutely everything we do. And then, given that we're going to have quite a lot of climate change now, we know we're going to have it, we can't stop it, however hard we try. Then we have some ability to, it's an insurance policy, if you like, if nothing else. We still have to do the mitigation, for sure, but that will give us some hope that our whole edifice of civilization, which after all has been built up over 10,000 years of essentially stable climate, that we can cope with some of the storms coming.
David?
I think of where not as a place, but what sorts of systems do we need to develop the resilience that Fred is talking about? Because we don't know where in terms of a place. And so I think that the best way to develop a resilient society, and despite the fact that I'm a nerdy scientist, I actually think that science, in terms of physical science or engineering, will not provide the solutions. We've had many examples in the last 3 years of unexpected, expected emergencies or natural disasters, which have demonstrated that the engineering solutions cannot provide the quick and rapid responses that are needed to deal with some of these natural disasters. And what we need is a resilient society in which community and society are developed in a way to respond in a resilient way to these crises or risks that are bound to come. Unfortunately, as Fred has just said, we don't know when and where those are coming. So what we need is a combination of technological responses, engineering responses, but what is most critical is community and societal systems that can react to and respond to these natural disasters that we know will come. We just can't predict exactly where and when they will come.
Colin?
There's a marvellous map that the New Scientist published a couple of years ago of the world in 2099 if climate change got to 4 degrees, if the warming got to 4 degrees, and most of the world is red, yellow and brown, and little bits of it are green, like Siberia, and for some reason a bit of Western Australia. And then there's a bit off to the east coast of Australia, except you can't see it. And the legend alongside it went roughly like this. Unrecognisable 100 million people. And I think that says that New Zealand, essentially the direct effects on New Zealand of climate change are relatively benign compared with just about anywhere else. So we actually have a vested interest in climate change going ahead because we get a comparative advantage out of it. Having said that, the... You're all too damn serious, aren't you? All right, I'll try the other one. I happened to be, God knows why I was invited, but there was a dinner of about four Nobel scientists who were here. This is about 3 years ago, and I raised the climate change issue because one of them actually wrote about it quite a lot. And I said, what do we do? He said, it's quite simple. The only solution is to reduce the world population by a factor of 10. That is, say, by take out 90%. God, you still aren't, are you? This is the adaptation argument, and frankly, I think the likelihood of an international agreement before 2020 that has any real teeth in it, as distinct from ground-up action, is highly unlikely. Therefore, we're going to be adapting, not mitigating, and I think that that's where the argument probably lies. I see this issue essentially as a subset of the much broader environment issue, and more proximate than climate change impacts will be water, fuel, food and resources for industry. And I think the crunches in those areas are going to come much faster. In fact, food has now spiked higher than it was in 2008 when there were widespread riots. Water is a very serious issue, and Fred knows vastly more about this than I do, having written that marvellous book, When the Rivers Run Dry. If you really want to make yourself happy and have little jokes, read that for a bit of fun. But so I began to get interested in water in the early 2000s, and then bits sort of dropped into place, and then his book came along, put it all together. China, how do you make cars in China if you've completely depleted the aquifers around the Yellow River, etc.? And India, how do you continue to grow food when you've gone down below the accessible aquifers, etc.? So water, food, fuel issues, etc. I think they're going to be much more proximate. But that just says that we're really talking about environment as a whole. If we, in this country, the policy approach, and I must say I see climate change not in scientific terms, I can't resolve that. My physics went to Sears and Zemanski in what's now the seventh form, and I read the New Scientist, I have done, but I'm not a scientist. Therefore, I have to leave the scientific argument aside. I accept that the weight of the majority opinion is that all this is happening and will go on happening, but unpredictably. So I see it in policy terms. That's what I can actually do with it. And to me, I very much like Paul Reynolds' approach, and I've said this in a couple of columns and got almost zero reaction. Instead, if you think of the environment as infrastructure, then you maintain it and invest in it and develop it. And it's important to the economy. It's part of the economy. We have a policy settings at the moment in New Zealand which say it's the environment or the economy. If you have a bit more environment, you have a bit less economy, and the other way around. I think that Paul's approach is much more logical, and it certainly ties back to climate change. If you start to see the environment generally and climate change as a subset of the environment argument generally, then you will start to say, well, this is actually part of the economy. It's not an and-or. And you change your approach to it.
Martin?
As the engineer on the table, I sort of feel a bit under attack from a couple of the earlier comments. And I'd just like to point out that I do think engineers know what a 1 in 100-year flood is. It's probably about half as big as the one you get next year. I think one of the the areas that really needs to be addressed, as was touched on by Martin Manning yesterday, and when he said that society needs to take over from science when it comes to risk management. And to a large extent, I think that's very much at the heart of it, that society, I think, is largely divorced from considerations of risk. And society typically doesn't need or doesn't feel the need to consider adverse outcomes. And perhaps the message needs to go out that it's not, you know, before we get to the doomsday scenario, we actually have to consider what will it be like when we get to a step partway in between. And then you've got the pendulum argument. At one end, is it going to be business as usual? And it's not going to be that. Is it going to be right at the other end where you're protected, you're lifted up, your insurance cuts in, the government picks up whatever's left? That's probably not going to happen either, but it's going to come somewhere in the middle. And if it, when it is in the middle, how does that affect the individual? How does that affect society? And there will be changes around that that society has to consider, that they will not have the protections that they currently enjoy. So it really does come down to, I think, about conditioning society for the changes that are ahead.
That was Martin Kreft, the regional manager of reinsurance giant Munich Re, addressing a breakfast session at the Climate Futures Conference in Wellington a couple of weeks ago. Earlier you heard from political commentator Colin James, climate expert Professor David Carrolly, and British author and environmental journalist Fred Pearce. How does a community come to grips with resilience challenges, particularly when there's no scientific certainty? I put this first to Martin Kreft.
There are going to be events which will show that actions are needed, and Christchurch is particularly one where we're going to end up with large parts of Christchurch where basically the governing authority will declare that that land is of little or no value. And we're going to come into a phase now where local government's going to have to face up to that, the citizens are going to have to face up to that, the banks are going to have to face up to it. There are examples there, and we will be able to use those going forward to say that as far as climate change is concerned, here is an example of what will happen.
Colin?
There's a first mover disadvantage. This is, as Ross Garnaut, I think, correctly said, this is the ultimate prisoner's dilemma. Whoever moves first actually loses, and if it's New Zealand moves first, the world doesn't gain anything because we're so damn small. So our issues are quite different. They are economic and international political issues and reputational issues. So that we might want to move because Unilever and Walmart, and I hadn't noticed that Walmart and Unilever were peopled at the top by tree-hugging, sandal-wearing greenies, are actually getting interested in total life cycle management and starting to implement programs about that. And I can name now four multinationals that were at something I was doing weekend before last, all of which are involved to a greater or lesser degree in total life cycle management from the beginning of suppliers right to the waste end by their consumers. These sorts of issues are going to drive responses in the end by our farmers and our processors, who are at the moment stuck in the slow lane operating at the speed of the slowest quintile. It's that sort of external action. Let's take China. Now, China actually has a climate change ambassador, but it's not actually interested in climate change. It is, however, very interested in changing the paradigm by which it gets rich, because China well knows it's not going to get rich using the American industrial paradigm, and therefore it has to look for other ways over time to develop its economy. And I don't know how successful it's going to be, but that's certainly one dimension. So what I'm getting at here is that if you take a moralistic approach and you say these things need to be done for the good of humanity, and you're the government saying that, you're likely to get almost a zero response except from about 5% of the population. So it's not that, it's the external events which will drive responses both here and elsewhere as well. The events that people have to respond to for other reasons, because the climate change arguments I don't think are going to become apparent, if at all, until around 2020 and beyond. I don't think you can blame earthquakes yet on climate change. And I think people will continue to say, well, this is an event, which we might or might not be climate change. We can't say. Therefore, we can't relate it back. Therefore, we're still in doubt. So a government trying to work against that.
Mm-hmm.
And then can I just say one final thing? And that is that if you get apocalyptic about this, people switch off. And if you live in Wellington, you well know this, because if there's an 8 earthquake in Wellington, an awful lot of it will fall down. There'll be thousands dead. There'll be a huge tsunami, wash it right up the Hutt Valley, and you won't be able to get in and out, and you won't have any electricity, gas, or anything, and it'll be pretty disastrous. So we just switch off. And the same argument is applying to, for instance, the lily pad argument. You all know what that is. The lily pads double in size every day, and if you start off with X amount, what happens? You get to the 29th day, it's half full. You've got one day left. And the apocalyptic arguments say we're already halfway through the 30th day. Wow, you know, may as well just drink up. So the arguments are going to come through, I don't think, persuasively. They're going to come through by events, and the events are going to be principally economic and political, externally to New Zealand principally.
Fred? Let me introduce a note of optimism, I think, actually. I think actually we may have passed that threshold that you're talking about. Now, it's slow and it's not happening as fast as it should. But most of the world understands that there's a problem. Much of the world is beginning to address these problems in personal ways, in corporate ways. Most large corporations now around the world recognize that they are going to have to at some point be moving to a low-carbon future. That is an extraordinary change in perception. Now, they've not necessarily enacted many of the things that they need to do that, but they kind of understand that in their corporate planning. They understand also that many of their consumers, the people that buy the stuff from them, also expect them to be moving in that direction. So you begin, almost the governments are almost the people lagging behind here, I think. They're waiting for... Governments are quite weak, actually, when it comes to it. They're waiting for strong signals from their electorate and from their corporate sponsors and all the rest of it before they act. And while those things line up, governments dither. But actually, I think we are moving... Now, whether we're doing it fast enough, I don't know, but we're moving in the right direction. Many corporations are now asking, give us the emissions targets. We know we can meet them because it's technologically not very hard. Tell us what the targets are and we can plan our investment around that. And many of them would quite like to do that because they think that gives them a greener image and so on. I was very struck at the Cancun climate negotiations in Mexico back last December that governments were dithering and not really making much progress, and there was a sense of whoever went first might be at a disadvantage. But behind the scenes, if all the sort of back meetings going on behind the scenes were about corporations and also governments saying what they were doing. They weren't waiting for a UN deal. They had their own internal reasons for wanting to do lots of things. So the European Union is committed to cutting its emissions by 20% regardless of what happens at the UN. Brazil and China and Mexico and other countries were saying we're going to not cut their emissions overall, but cut the intensity, the carbon intensity of their economies. Now, we can say, and I would certainly say, that these things are not enough, but they are a real sign that over the sort of 20 years that we've been talking about these things, actually real things are happening, and especially changes in perception. So I think we may have passed that threshold. But there are two thresholds here. There's the natural system threshold and there's the human system threshold. Can we actually enact the things that we're doing before the natural system hits some threshold which sets away runaway climate change or something? I don't have an answer to that, but I think we're making quite good progress in many ways.
Yeah. Can I
just add very briefly? The London Mirror yesterday, I suppose, the actual date, has found that 45% of the younger generation think climate change is man-made, but only 26% of people close to retiring age agree. So the real solution to get rid of the baby boom is real fast.
Well, we're managing to do that ourselves. David, are we seeing decentralisation, the so-called Plan B on climate change, beginning to take precedence now, led presumably from what Fred is saying, by the private sector? And what are the implications of that?
Well, let me go back a little bit to what you said earlier about, I think, the debate among scientists, because, in fact, in terms of uncertainty, yes, there are uncertainty about many of the details of climate change, but there are some things we know with very, very high confidence that climate change will lead and is already leading to significant increases in global temperatures, significant increases in the risk of hot extremes, and they're already being experienced not only in Moscow and in Europe and in Australia, but many places around the world, and significant increases in sea level leading to significant increases in sea level extremes, coastal erosion. So those things are known with very, very high confidence. So we can plan for those. Saying that we need very, very high confidence for governments to act is something which is used as a sort of bailout clause, because governments did not need a great deal of certainty in terms of acting on the global financial crisis. They invested trillions of dollars in terms of an unknown response because they perceived that if they didn't, they would lose the election. What they don't perceive with climate change is that they will lose an election if they don't respond quickly in some countries. And two of those countries are Australia and the United States, where there is a lot of debate. But the certainty about climate change should not be used as an excuse for inaction or for the climate change extremes, because we know, not just scientists, but the community, that changes are already being experienced. That can be very closely linked to early evidence of the sorts of extremes we expect in the future to get much worse, but are already linked to climate change. And there are numerous scientific studies that are linking increases in hot extremes, increases in sea level to human-caused climate change. So now back to your question, plan B versus plan A. I'm not sure that I know what plan A ever was, except mitigate, given the evidence, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think plan B was adapt, and it sort of took into account this, if you like, wait-and-see aspect of many governments. So plan B, yes, businesses and communities around the world are already acting, recognising that in many locations there is increasing risk from extreme events. And that, as we already heard, isn't just extreme events associated with climate change, it's many sorts of systems. It's unclear whether developed countries are necessarily more resilient than developing countries in terms of those sorts of responses. But I think it is clear that community level and businesses are already acting. However, there are some bad, examples that show that while at community level there can be some responses, there are also some mistakes. And the worst ones are the relatively short lifetime of the memory at a community level of the extreme events. And in particular, the worst examples are in Australia, where people are building in wildfire-prone areas and building massively because tree huggers like to be close to trees. And in addition to sea change, which puts you at risk from sea level rise, there are tree changers in Australia who want to be close to where the bushfires are the worst. And it's not clear that that's a rational, long-term resilient decision. It is clear that there are other factors and that the short-term memory of these disasters in Australia, building in floodplains, building close to the ocean and building close to forests, demonstrates resilient behaviour. It's clear that it doesn't. So yes, community-level responses are really important, but we have to try to provide some guidance about the exposure and the resilience of those behaviours.
Who's we?
That's a really good question, because it is not coming from within the community. So in that case, I would have argued that that we will be some of the insurance companies who say, we cannot insure you if you build below the floodplain level. We cannot insure you if you build in a bushfire high-risk area. And we cannot insure you if you build below average sea level.
Martin, how well is the insurance industry coping or responding to what is they know is going to be hugely increased demand?
As a company, and revolving around the climate issues, I mean, we've got a staff of 17 scientists and backup staff in Munich, and they're looking at a number of different areas of operation. Some are in Plan A and some are in Plan B. There's the ongoing, I guess, day-to-day thing is really around assessing climate change and therefore assessing insurability, because if there's no insurance, there's no reinsurance. So that's really around the longevity of the company. I guess it's a selfish aim. I think one of the things that society don't understand, and in this regard probably the insurance industry are very poor ambassadors at it, is that opinions change. And whilst today we may insure your house in the floodplain, tomorrow we might not. Mm. And I think that's part of this issue that I'm talking about, that society needs to get into risk management. And part of the risk management argument for society is they actually have to face up to the that there will be changes. There will be significant changes in the way the whole economic system operates, and that may be well one of them.
Will that result in behaviour change? Is that one of the big drivers for behaviour change, you think?
Well, I think it is, because the first thing that happens if an insurance type solution fails is that people look for a social welfare solution,
which is another form of insurance.
It is.
And that was engineer and regional representative for reinsurance company Munich Re, Martin Kreft, with some home truths on the insurance front at the Climate Futures Conference in Wellington earlier this month. The other participants were Professor David Carrolly of the University of Melbourne, political commentator Colin James, and British author and environmental journalist Fred Pearce. So, what responsibilities do governments and local governments have when it comes to imposing rules and adopting risk management measures? And how much does that depend on citizens accepting that there isn't any other choice? I asked Fred Pearce how much it depends on governments' willingness to regulate.
Well, it's regulatory in the sense that it's presumably governments are going to decide whether they build a seawall or not, or if that's, I suppose, unmanaged retreat. But I mean, if at some level it has to be regulatory, it has to be about government. But that can only successfully happen in a situation where people kind of understand what's going on. And I think that involves more kind of wider acceptance of things within society. You asked a minute ago about who the we are in all this, who the we are that are going to do these things. I think probably scientists are the last people who ought to be involved. Part of the problem, I think, with the whole climate change debate at the minute is that it is still dominated by scientists. If you ask a question about climate change, you always ask, kind of almost routinely will ask a scientist. And maybe scientists are no longer the most appropriate people to ask about a whole range of things. I think personally, that scientists have dominated the climate change debate too long, and it's time, given that the big stuff is known, and there are arguments about the small stuff, but the big stuff is known pretty clearly, we should back off. I would be much happier if the climate debate was dominated by, novelists and poets and filmmakers social society, rather than always the scientists who come up on the table to answer the question about these things. Scientists are almost part of the problem now.
Yes.
Although I'm not sure that some recent examples of novels by Michael Crichton or films like Day After Tomorrow are necessarily the best roles that we could use for planning climate change adaptation.
But there's a scientist talking. I'm in favour of those kind of things taking over, because then it becomes part of a much wider discourse, and it is not something that the boffins do, and it is not something that the greenies bang on about and bore us silly with. It is something which is much more part of society. And we've made some progress doing that, but we need to make more, and I think probably scientists letting go is part of that.
There is an example in the state of Victoria and around the lakes entrance area in Victoria, where the local council made a politically brave decision to set limits on commercial development, not just at sea level, but within the expected range of extreme events for the next 50 years. And they set a building limit which was 1.1 metres above the current expected extreme risk associated with storm surge. The outcry from commercial developers was phenomenal, and there are legal challenges. But the commercial developers' return period is typically 10 years or less. They actually don't care whether the infrastructure that they're selling, because these are houses, the commercial developers don't have a responsibility to ensure that they are still standing when the storm surge or the waves erode their foundations. Mm. So the brave decision from this council has still stood, but it is being challenged. But the difference between the timescale for a commercial return, 10 years or less, versus an infrastructure lifetime is a very, very important differentiation between vested interests. The person who's buying that house would probably like to be able to give that beach home, holiday home or residence and have it available for their children to hand over. The commercial developer has a very different timescale.
This raises the whole question of this question of planning and spatial planning in particular. There's a debate going on in this country about the merits of much more conscious spatial planning. Auckland Super City has headed off down that path. Colin, you want to comment on this? Where's this going to take us? I mean, is spatial planning where it's at in terms of regulating who can build where? I mean, it would seem to me to be a no-brainer, but what do you say?
Auckland spatial plan is a bit different because it's been legislated for separately from the long-term council LTCCPs, I keep forgetting the two C's, which do have to take a 10-year and 30-year horizon, look out 10 years and 30 years, and that's principally for infrastructure reasons, but that, of course, butts on to things like seawalls. So is that spatial planning? I have trouble with that phrase. I haven't yet had explained to me by Roger Blakely exactly what it is, and so that's why they've called it the Auckland Plan instead of calling it the spatial plan. There's a bit of a problem with terminology there, I suppose. But yes, it is. If you are charged by the law with looking out 30 years and investing ratepayers' money in activities to do with the infrastructure, and I use that word again, that widest sense that I used it earlier, it includes ecosystems and the environment, then that's probably where the cutting edge is. But how do you write in climate change into that? I'm not very sure. You then have to go back to your scientists, don't you?
Yes.
Can I ask Martin, what sort of time frame do reinsurers look out? Is it just 1 year, or do you do 5 years, or what do? 30-year horizon scans? I mean, how do you deal with this? Because it was actually in this room about quite some years ago, I was chairing a session that it really came home to me that the insurance companies were starting to take climate change really seriously at that point. And it was a reinsurance company. I can't remember which one exactly. But do you have these sort of timeframes in your mind or what?
Fixed timeframes are a bit hard to reconcile. It's a bit like our head office asking us what our claims ratio is going to be in 5 years' time. An awful lot of effort goes into projections. And an awful lot of those projections are around peak scenarios, and from that is derived our reinsurance behaviours. We've got a number, probably I think there's something like 40 different scenarios around the globe, of which Wellington earthquake is one, so we're right up there. More than half of them are weather-related scenarios. And, for example, there's about three around the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, and they regulate our behaviour in terms of acceptance of risk in those areas. We have the same mechanisms around Wellington earthquake. So those are there, and I think one of the things that climate change will show is that we as an industry have to put an awful lot more effort into non-peak scenarios. And I think that's where we're getting caught out, and that's probably I guess not the official view, but to have the number of weather events that we've had in Australia in the last 12 to 18 months has proven that whilst we do focus on peak scenarios, there's an awful lot of non-peak scenario events around which can erode your allowance for large claims. Mm. And that's where our focus, I'm sure, will come in, is the examination of the other thousands of non-peak scenarios that we haven't focused on.
So you can, apart from just not insuring, you can also charge premiums. I mean, you ought to charge us a whacking great premium for, well, your insurers that you reinsure for living in Wellington, shouldn't you? To discourage us from building houses here and maybe shift out. There is a real difference between insurance companies that I think have been taking this seriously for quite some time and associated finance sectors. But if you look at the drivers for the Unilevers and Walmarts of this world, it's essentially aiming to make money out of the rapidly expanding middle classes, and particularly in Asia, because the middle classes in North Atlantic countries are pretty much fixed. They're not going to grow a lot more as proportions of population, but the rest are. And these people want to make money out of those people. That's why they're doing it. There's a spin-off in environmental terms, but it is not the primary aim of it. I actually agree with Fred. I mean, these changes in the last few years have been remarkable, and I can see them going in only one direction. And they're not doing it to be nice. They're doing it to make profits for shareholders, and they're doing it to make long-term profits for shareholders. And so that's going to drive a lot of these changes.
That was political commentator Colin James speaking at the Climate Futures Conference in Wellington earlier this month. You also heard from Martin Kreft, the regional manager of Munich Re, environmental journalist Fred Pearce, and IPPC member David Caroley. The panel was also asked a number of challenging questions from the audience, including this one to Martin Kreft.
Good morning. My question's for Martin, really, and it's to do with the adaptive capacity of the insurance industry, and you've been taking some big hits recently. How many big hits can the global rear insurance business cope with?
I think if you're following it in the press at the moment, the current status is that anything further of a significant nature this year, this calendar year, will be capital eroding. What we've had to date have been events which have been profit eroding, if you like. Once you get into capital erosion, the whole dynamic of the industry will change, and it will change significantly. And then we will get into the question that Colin was asking around why aren't we charging people in Wellington an awful lot more for their earthquake insurance? That's one step down the track. The next step down the track is to say that there will be significantly limited capital available for Wellington earthquake, and then it won't matter how much you want to pay for it. If there is only a certain amount of capital allocated, able to be allocated by the insurance and reinsurance industry to whatever event it is, then you are into restrictions whereby you will only be able to get 20%, 30%, 40% coverage.
Are we at that point already, you think?
No, but I think the modellers are under intense pressure, and the pressure is around the whole range of large loss scenarios, whether it's earthquake, whether it's bushfire, whether it's flood, whether it's cyclone or whatever. They are under the blowtorch is definitely on the modellers.
Yeah. Next question.
Kia ora, good morning. I think there's a huge opportunity that hasn't been talked about this morning, and that's in the education sector. We in this country are seeing more and more and more schools getting involved in education for sustainability and learning the sort of skills that I've heard from the panel this morning. We need to design things differently, we need to be making decisions differently, we need to be taking risk into account. My question is, if you could design the education system, what would you have in it to create the next generation that's going to do things in the way that is sustainable?
Education's about two things in my dumb appreciation of education. One is about acquiring some sort of knowledge of what's around you, and how to, and the second is how to deal with it. Part of how to deal with it is to be sceptical in a very small s sense of that word, so that if you are propagandized from any source, and you might include, say, as in the United States, you have the anti-evolutionists and creationists, if you're bombarded by that because that's mandated in your school, that doesn't help you to become, to develop into thinking, contributing citizens. I think the question you've posed is not the whole question. The idea that you import something into the education system because it's the right thing to teach is exactly what the creationists are on about, and I happen to think that's unfortunate.
I think Colin's right about critical thinking, and you know, that's going to be more valuable than any sort of a creed that you lay down in a school, if I can put it that way. But my impression is that most, certainly in Europe, and I would guess here too, most teachers are really rather good about talking about environmental themes and recycling and a personal awareness about environmental issues. I certainly know that my kids have grown up much greener than I've taught myself to be. And they've got that from school. So, I mean, you know, yes, do more, but my sense is the education system has done a pretty good job here in many ways.
Let's throw the question back. Should it be done at the local level? In other words, save our local patch, our local community, the quality of the soils, the air, the water, etc., or should it be save the planet?
In my experience, working with schools now for over 10 years, something you said before, Colin, is really relevant, is deal with the issues that are actually up front for people. So climate change, we're not really aware of the effects that well. We can't see them, we don't understand them that well because they're coming. We can see that our rivers are polluted. We can see that our forests are disappearing and our birds are disappearing. And if we deal with those things, and actually children want to, they're desperate to deal with those things because they're fun, they're engaging, they get outside, and those things are the things that schools are dealing with. And I don't agree that our education system is doing a good job. I think we are still working in the same paradigm, the paradigm of getting kids out to do jobs that keep the economy going. We need a totally different way of thinking, systemic thinking, long-term thinking, and that comes from young people being able to take action, make decisions, and deal with their own issues at their own level.
Rod.
Apologies to the rest of the panel, because this is probably only a question that Colin might want to address, or perhaps you too, Chris. We already have a climate stroke housing issue of multi-billion dollar proportions, which is leaky homes. So what have government, the building sector and homeowners learnt from that or not?
Resilient houses. Colin?
I'd be interested in your answer, Rod. I'm sure that
my answer is very straightforward. Nothing.
I thought you might actually have an answer. I would agree. The initial answer to leaky homes by the Labour-led government was pretty heavy regulation. The current government is lightening that regulation again, trying to get it back to something that we call balance. Whether that stops another leaky homes episode, but I'm trying to relate that to climate change. I'm not at all clear. I mean, I do understand it's a problem for the people who live in those houses. Yeah.
No, well, it's very straightforward, because it was about a building sector that didn't understand, by choice or not, what it was building and how resilient those homes were and how inadequate the technology was they were using. It was a desire of governments not to...
I thought they just used bad materials and put them in badly.
So we're going to adapt to climate change by using bad materials and putting them in badly. Don't we learn something from that?
No, I don't think we've learned something from that. And to go back to my argument before, I think that we are going to muddle through this. We're going to be reactive in short terms rather than long term timeframes. Yeah. Fred and I are in agreement with this. It's going to be driven from elsewhere rather than, and the private sector is an international private sector seeking really brand advantage is going to be driving a lot of it.
If you
want to be a builder in New Zealand, you want to be a big builder, not a one house at a time builder, but a big builder like Fletcher Building. you will want to have a brand that says we put up safe, warm, comfortable, durable houses.
Otherwise, well, they won't buy them.
Yeah, but we also need to find a way to do some of that of ourselves rather than just sort of import all the technology or the materials, because we have some particular issues around our climate and environment and how we want to live. So I think we need to learn how to do all that better, because we can't muddle through losing a few billion dollars a time.
Who's the we?
New Zealand.
So let me...
David?
I don't know about leaky homes, but I think I know enough to comment on it. There are two completely contrary examples in Australia. One where, if you like, regulation has worked, and that is an example of the resilient housing that in tropical cyclone-exposed areas in northeastern Australia. Tropical cyclone Yasi was an extremely strong Category 5 tropical cyclone, and it had, in terms of the homes that were in its path, the tropical cyclone building regulations caused dramatically less damage on those homes from wind stress than the homes that were basically destroyed by Tropical Cyclone Tracy in 1974. And that was through changing building regulations. The building regulations, however, were about wind damage, not storm surge damage. And there was a big change as well, and all the buildings that got damaged, or almost all the buildings that got damaged by Tropical Cyclone Yasi, were from the storm surge, not from the winds. So, good news, bad news. The other example is that throwing money by the government at buildings in a solution can lead to perverse and often stupid outcomes. And the Australian government decided, not through regulation, but through investment, to throw a lot of money, $500 million, at a home insulation scheme. And what did it do? It killed people. Mm. Because the investment of money, injection of that amount of money overnight into the home insulation scheme led to fly-by-night installers who basically didn't know what they were doing, installed the insulation incorrectly, and people were getting killed through electrical faults and short circuits and building fires. And it is clear that there will be litigation on this topic for the next probably decade associated with bad installation. So throwing money at a problem will not always solve it.
Yeah, so that was David Carrolly, Australian climate scientist and IPCC member, well-known science communicator, ending that discussion on resilience recorded at Te Papa a couple of weeks ago during a breakfast debate held as part of the Climate Change Research Institute Conference on Responses to Global Warming. The other members of the panel were Fred Pearce, a British environmental journalist and author of best-selling books When the Rivers Run Dry and The Climate Files, Martin Kreft, a New Zealand engineer who also plays a leading role in project financing and particularly insurance issues, and Colin James, New Zealand political journalist, author and analyst. And that's it for Ideas this week.